Ever feel like you're just drowning in information? You want that key insight, that aha moment, but without wading through everything.
Yeah, totally.
Well, that's what we're doing here. Think of this as your shortcut to getting properly informed.
And today we are diving deep into some really fascinating research. It's from Professor Teng Fei at Wuhan University's School of Resource and Environmental Sciences.
Professor Fei's work is really interesting because he doesn't just stick to one field, does he?
Not at all. He's combining things like geospatial data science, which is like, you know, advanced mapping,
right,
and remote sensing, AI, big data analytics. It's this mix that makes his findings so powerful.
Exactly. So our mission today is to pull out the most, well, compelling and useful bits from his work.
Yeah, we'll look at cities, the environment, public health, even some of the core methods he's developing for analyzing geographic info. And a lot of it gives a really valuable look at the Chinese context specifically.
And we've got plenty to work with his own research papers, plus reports looking at his impact. Okay, let's unpack this, starting with cities.
Sounds good. Professor Fei's work gives us some, really eye-opening ways to look at how our cities change and how we, you know, interact with them.
Like how?
Well, a big one is using data on how people move within a city to predict urban growth better.
That's interesting. So not just zoning maps, but actual movement. How does that work?
There's one study focusing on Beijing where they basically fed human movement patterns into this complex simulation model. It's called an artificial neural network-based cellular automata model. ANNCA for short.
Okay, ANNCA, slow down. Simpler terms.
Yeah. Imagine a really advanced SimCity game, right? But where the way the little digital people move around actually teaches the simulation how the city's likely to expand.
Ah, got it. So it learns from where people go. Yeah. And was it more accurate than the old ways?
Oh, yeah, significantly. It really boosted the accuracy of predicting actual growth compared to, you know, the standard models. They saw better scores on things like the Cohen's Kappa coefficient, the figure of merit, basically measures of how well the predictions matched reality.
So it's not just guessing based on what's next door, it's understanding the pull of human activity.
Exactly. The study even pinpointed specific areas in Beijing, places like Chaoyang, Daxing, Shunyi, where this model was way more accurate. It really showed this strong link. Where there's more intense human interaction, you tend to see more urban growth.
Which leads to a big question for city planners, doesn't it? Mm. What's the takeaway for them?
Well, it strongly suggests that planning can't just be about zoning anymore. You have to consider how people actually move. Good public transport, mixed-use areas, accessible public spaces.
And not just nice-to-haves.
Exactly. They're fundamental forces shaping physical growth. Thinking about mobility patterns can lead to, well, smarter, more resilient cities.
That makes a lot of sense. A place that's easy to get around just naturally draws people and development. Now, Professor Fei also talks about urban vibrancy. That sounds like more than just how busy a place is.
You're right, it is. There's a paper on using mobile phone data and an improved PageRank algorithm. Yes, like the one Google uses to measure vibrancy. It looks beyond just counting heads.
Mobile phone data again.
Yeah.
So how does that tell you if a neighborhood's vibrant?
Well, by analyzing anonymized movement patterns and the types of places people go, you get a sense of the diversity of activity. Are there shops, offices, cafes, parks, cultural spots? The algorithm helps weigh this mix.
Okay, so a neighborhood with, say, lots of different kinds of businesses and spaces would rank higher than maybe a purely residential one. Even if the number of people is similar.
Precisely. And think how useful that is for planners. They can use this data to see if, you know, putting in that new park actually boosted the area's vibrancy.
Or compare different neighborhoods.
Yeah, to guide investments. Where do you need more diverse infrastructure or public spaces to liven things up? It's like taking the pulse of a neighborhood's economic and social life.
A pulse check. I like that.
Yeah.
Okay. Shifting gears a bit. Emotional geography. Mapping emotions. That sounds pretty out there.
It's definitely cutting edge. The idea is to map where different human emotions seem to cluster globally and see if there are links to the physical environment. He's got papers looking at this using like Flickr photos and census data.
But how do you even start mapping something so personal, so subjective?
The approach is pretty clever. They use emotion recognition tech on facial expressions in public Flickr photos. Then, and this is the really novel part, they treat different emotions almost like biological species.
Species. Like, happiness lives here, sadness lives there.
Sort of. They use ecological models, species distribution models, to predict the likely habitat for each emotion based on environmental factors. They identified 7 key dimensions of emotion from the photos.
Okay, I'm trying to wrap my head around that. What kind of environmental factors are we talking about?
Things you might expect, like the amount of green space, building density, maybe noise levels, but also socioeconomic characteristics of an area.
And they look for correlations, like more parks equals more happy faces in photos from that area.
Essentially, yeah. By finding these associations, they can start to understand how our surroundings might influence our collective mood.
Could this actually change city design? Could we, like, build for emotional well-being, create these habitats?
That's the really exciting potential, isn't it? If you know certain environments are linked to positive emotions, planners could prioritize those features. Maybe add more green space in areas showing higher levels of negative emotion signals.
Wow. Imagine emotional heat maps guiding planning decisions.
It's a radical idea designing cities based on feelings, not just function or looks, moving beyond just making places work to making them feel good.
That is powerful. Okay, Professor Fay also uses more direct ways to sense the urban environment, right? Like noise and pedestrian movement.
Absolutely. His team's developed some smart methods using advanced sensing. For instance, one study estimated road noise levels just by analyzing street view imagery with deep learning AI.
Wait, from Google Street View pictures?
Yeah.
Seriously, how accurate is that?
Surprisingly accurate. They got good results. And what's really cool is the AI could also identify which visual elements, like lots of traffic, types of buildings, sound walls, were the biggest clues for predicting noise levels.
That's amazing. And the pedestrian tracking.
Yeah, another study used drones with computer vision, things like YOLA 5 and DeepSort, to monitor how fast people were walking on streets.
Drones watching us walk?
Well, monitoring speeds, yeah. They achieved over 90% accuracy, pinpointing speeds very precisely.
Okay, but why? What's the use case for knowing walking speed?
It's valuable for urban design planning pedestrian zones, checking if street layouts work well for walking, even safety and crowd management. It all ties into this concept Professor Fay uses called perception proxies.
Perception proxies, what's that about?
It's the idea that you can use easily available visual data like street view, drone footage, and process it with AI to infer things about the environment or behavior that are usually hard or expensive to measure directly.
So instead of putting noise sensors everywhere?
You use the images as a proxy, or drone footage instead of manually counting pedestrians. It makes detailed urban monitoring much cheaper and more accessible for planners, researchers, community groups. Anyone, really.
Right. Getting a richer picture without needing sensors on every corner. Okay, this gives a great sense of the city work. Let's switch now to the broader environment, soil and water health.
Yeah, Professor Fay does a lot here too, particularly using spectroscopy analyzing light to assess the environment quickly and, crucially, non-destructively. He uses visible and near-infrared, or VISNIR, and hyperspectral imaging quite a bit.
So analyzing light reflected off soil or plants.
Exactly. It allows for a rapid assessment of things like soil organic carbon, a key indicator of soil health, and detecting heavy metal pollution like cadmium, lead, arsenic in both soil and plants.
Without digging lots of holes and lab tests.
That's the goal. For instance, one paper looked at improving soil organic carbon estimates using something called semi-supervised regression. This technique helps get good results even with limited ground truth samples, which is a common problem in large-scale studies.
Right. You can't sample everywhere, so it makes the spectral data more powerful on its own.
Pretty much. Another important finding came from looking at heavy metals in suburban soil. They found the link between the spectral signal and the metal concentration wasn't the same everywhere. It varied spatially.
Ah, so the same light signature could mean different things in different spots.
Exactly. So they advocated for using a method called multi-scale geographically weighted regression, or MGWR. It basically adapts the model to these local differences.
Making the pollution maps more accurate locally.
Yes, significantly more accurate. There's other work, too, on detecting multiple metals in rice leaves, optimizing how much spectral detail you need. The big picture is about developing adaptive models that handle the patchiness and limitations of real-world environmental data.
And the payoff is?
More precise, cost-effective environmental management, detailed soil health maps, better pollution risk assessments for cleanup, optimizing fertilizer use, ensuring food safety. Really practical stuff.
Makes sense. Okay, what about water? Similar approaches.
Yes, particularly focusing on detecting smaller water bodies, ponds, streams, and their water quality, especially in tricky urban or agricultural landscapes.
Those smaller ones can be hard to spot from space, I guess.
They are. They're small, Pixels and satellite images often cover both water and land, and their water can look very different. Traditional methods for big lakes don't always work.
So what did his team do?
A study in Wuhan proposed a really robust method that got high accuracy over 95% for just finding the water bodies and over 90% for estimating water quality parameters from the imagery.
That's impressive. Did they look at why the quality varied?
They did. They found a link to human activity intensity, and interestingly, the impact differed depending on whether the surrounding land use was, say, intensive agriculture versus more leisure-focused areas.
So different human pressures have different effects.
Exactly. And this builds on earlier work monitoring things like sediment in larger lakes, too. Being able to monitor even small water bodies accurately is vital for urban resilience, ecological health. Understanding these human impacts helps guide land use planning and protect water resources.
It all connects back. Land use, water quality,
Okay,
and agriculture. You mentioned remote sensing there, too.
Absolutely. Using hyperspectral data, again, from drones and satellites to assess crop health and optimize farming, there's work on classifying tea cultivars, for instance.
Classifying tea types from the air.
Yeah. With UAV-mounted hyperspectral cameras, they got over 95% accuracy. And even cooler, they could estimate levels of biochemicals related to tastes like polyphenols and amino acids.
Wow. So you could potentially predict tea quality or flavor remotely.
That's the implication. Another study looked at optimizing grassland carrying capacity, how many animals it can support. But they didn't just look at biomass, the amount of grass.
They looked at quality.
Exactly. Using satellite hyperspectral data, they incorporated indicators of grass quality, its nutritional value for livestock. This is pushing towards quality-driven precision agriculture, managing not just for yield, but for quality, which has direct economic and ecological benefits.
That's a subtle but important shift. Okay, we've covered a lot of ground, literally. Let's bring it back to people and public health. The Environment Health Link seems key.
It really is. Professor Fay's team has done significant work here, particularly on residential greenness, the amount of green space around where people live, and health outcomes.
We all sort of feel parks are good for us. What's the hard evidence?
Well, one prospective cohort study looked at older adults with disabilities. They found that higher residential greenness was linked to lower all-cause mortality, a lower risk of dying from any cause.
Okay, that's significant. Why? What's the mechanism?
Part of it, the study found, was mediated by air pollution. The green space likely helps reduce levels of pollutants like PM2.5, CO, NO2, SO2, O3.
So the trees are literally cleaning the air, leading to better health.
That seems to be a major pathway, yes. But the protective effect also varied by age, gender, disability level, even how often people got outdoors. It suggests greenness acts in multiple ways, and we need to plan green spaces strategically to maximize benefits, especially for vulnerable groups. It's about health equity, too.
Right. Not just if there's green space, but where and for whom. What about direct air pollution effects?
There's important work there, too, again, focusing on vulnerable populations. One study examined mortality risk for people living with HIV, looking at different levels of PM2.5 exposure and how severe their HIV was.
And findings.
Higher PM2.5 concentrations significantly increased mortality risk, as you might expect, but the impact was disproportionately larger for those with lower CD4 counts, meaning more severe immune deficiency.
So air pollution hits the already vulnerable hardest.
Exactly. They used advanced statistical methods, like the parametric G formula, to estimate risk under hypothetical scenarios where pollution was reduced. It provides quantitative evidence for policymakers. It really highlights this concept of intersectional vulnerability and the need for environmental justice. Clean air policies need to protect everyone, but especially those at highest risk.
A stark reminder. Now, something completely different, but also health-related. Dietary taste preferences and chronic diseases. That sounds like a leap.
It's a really novel approach. They explored quantitative links between dominant regional tastes in China and the prevalence of certain chronic diseases.
How on earth do you measure regional taste? Do they survey people?
No, they used big data, crowdsourced online recipe data, and points of interest data, like restaurants and food vendors.
Clever. So analyzing recipes and food places to map dominant flavors.
Exactly. They quantified preferences for 7 tastes, salty, sweet, spicy, etc., by looking at seasoning frequency in recipes and the types of food POIs across different provinces.
And then link that to disease rates.
Yeah, using a method called geodetector. They found associations, for example, excessive salt preference linked strongly to hemorrhagic stroke risk and excessive spiciness to upper respiratory infections.
That's fascinating. Using unconventional data to get population health insights.
It really shows the power of mining these kinds of big data sources. It's a new paradigm, potentially, finding health determinants in readily available data, which could make large-scale monitoring and intervention much more cost-effective.
Okay, we've seen the applications across cities, environment, health. Underlying all this must be some serious methodological innovation, right? He's not just using off-the-shelf tools.
Definitely not. He and his team are pushing the boundaries of geospatial data science. One example is a spatial clustering method they developed called SDCC.
SDCC, what does that do?
It's for multivariate spatial clustering, grouping geographic areas based on multiple characteristics. But the key thing is, it explicitly considers spatial contiguity. It tries to keep clusters geographically connected.
So it avoids grouping area A with area Z? Just because they're similar on paper, if they're miles apart.
Precisely. Traditional methods might do that. SDC builds in a mechanism to encourage neighboring objects to belong to the same cluster while still respecting the data similarity. It performs better than baseline methods in finding meaningful, geographically coherent patterns.
Which is useful for?
Oh, lots of things. Delineating functional urban areas, identifying regions with similar environmental risks that are actually connected, clustering neighborhoods. It bridges that gap between attribute similarity and geographic proximity.
Makes sense. And network analysis, that seems relevant everywhere today.
Yes. They've extended graph theory to better analyze the robustness and sensitivity of complex geographic networks, like transportation systems.
Going beyond just seeing if nodes are connected.
Right. Traditional graph theory often simplifies things. This work, exemplified in a study on China's high-speed rail, uses a more complex way to represent how nodes work together in combinations, a co-occurrence pattern truth table. This allows them to propose new metrics, like positive sensitivity to measure a node's true importance, and network sensitivity for overall robustness. It captures how critical certain combinations of links are, not just individual ones.
So a deeper understanding of potential failure points and resilience.
Exactly. The results on the rail network were different from traditional metrics, showing that true resilience depends on these combinatorial relationships.
Fascinating. And finally, pulling it all together, it seems like the integration of different tools is a constant theme.
Absolutely. That's perhaps the biggest methodological strength, the seamless integration of AI and machine learning with advanced remote sensing and all sorts of big data, mobile data, social media, street view, recipes, you name it.
We've seen examples throughout.
Yeah. Deep learning for image analysis like noise or pedestrian speed, machine learning for classification like T-types or regression for soil carbon, network algorithms like PageRank for vibrancy or these new sensitivity metrics, data fusion is key.
Combining drone data with satellite data or street view with noise measurements.
Right. It's a synergy combining diverse data streams with smart algorithms that unlocks the real power. It leads to more accurate predictions, deeper understanding. It's the foundation for building things like urban or environmental digital twins for real-time monitoring and better policymaking.
This has been, wow, incredibly comprehensive. The sheer breadth and depth of Professor Fei's research is pretty staggering.
It really is. His work is just a fantastic example of how bringing different disciplines together using cutting-edge tech with sharp analysis can lead to genuinely practical solutions for major urban and environmental issues.
So as you're listening to this, maybe think about your own field, your own interests. How could integrating different kinds of data, maybe using AI, lead to breakthroughs there? What are the hidden perception proxies, the indirect clues that could unlock new understanding in areas you care about?
It's a great thought exercise.
Professor Fei's work definitely pushes us to think more creatively about using the data all around us. And of course, if any specific study we mentioned caught your interest, definitely look up the papers for a much deeper dive.